Good morning. I hope you all had a wonderful weekend. I'm glad to have you here. We left off on Friday talking about some of the groups on the periodic table. And the groups on the periodic table go top to bottom. Periods go left to right, and those are cool too, but it's the groups that we're really after more than anything else. Now, there's two ways that the groups are represented, and the one that's represented right here is through a numbering system. It starts on the left at 1 and goes to the right on 18. So you can see that for these different groups, there's like two designations. The number is what I call the international version of the periodic table. But these 1As, 2As, 7As, etc., that's the one that we're going to use more than not. That's the so-called American version of the periodic table. And on those, there's some pretty important ones to know. We'll talk a lot about alkali metals, which are the group 1A metals, the ones on the far left. We'll talk quite a bit about the alkaline earth metals, which are right next door. And again, if these terms are new to you, do realize that they sound very similar to each other, but their properties are actually quite different. The halogens and the noble gases are the other two I'd really like you to know. And the one on the far, far right, those are the noble gases. And the one right next to it, the halogens, are also really important. Now, there's some other terms that we'll talk about throughout the term. I'll talk about twisted metals later on and why they're kind of twisted. Once in a while, the terms pnictogens or chalcogens will show up. But most of the time, it's those two on the left and the two on the right that are really important. So you might see a question that looks like this. This is just a question that asks your names of the different pieces. And it's an alkali metal, a pnictogen, followed by a halogen. And again, the alkali metals, that's the group 1A. The pnictogen, since you can see it right here, is group 5A. And that's not as important of a group to know, but it's still one I want you to hear the term. And then halogen is group 7. And like we talked about on Friday, if you look through that list long enough, rubidium is towards the bottom of the alkali metals, and then antimony is a group 5A system, a pnictogen, and astatine is a rare halogen at the very bottom. Okay, so do be aware that we'll use those terms sometimes, and they're not hard, just getting used to them as part of it. So that being said, let's talk about some of the properties of these different groups. Because in chemistry, the groups, the up and down parts, those are the chemicals that are going to be very similar to each other, and that's what we'll see.
The main engine of the NASA space shuttle is fueled by the elements oxygen and hydrogen. A huge amount of energy is required to lift the shuttle into orbit. When mixed and ignited, the fuels produce water and a large quantity of energy.
Hydrogen is kind of an anomaly. It's officially group 1A, but it's not really a metal. And like we saw on Friday, sometimes it's above group 7A, the halogens. So for right now, let's just think about hydrogen as being kind of special, but in a good way special. It's what got the space shuttles into orbit and stuff like that. It's a very powerful gas. In 1939, there was the Hindenburg crash, which was really famous. It was a German Zeppelin that came down in the United States. It was the way they were getting people across. I personally just like talking about, Led Zeppelin, yeah, okay. If it's too loud, you're too old. Anyway, just realize if you've seen that cover album, that's what it is about. Anyway, really exciting to me, though, is this part right here. Now, because it's a group 1A, an alkali metal, people hadn't seen actual metallic hydrogen until very, very recently. We're going to talk more in the next section about what metals are, but metals are really good about conducting electricity. They'll give up electrons, and under extreme pressure situations, you can now make metallic hydrogen. They've always postulated that it was in the center of like Jupiter, one of these really intense, kind of high atmosphere kind of things, but they were able to make it in a lab in Germany just recently, so we'll hear even more about hydrogen coming up.
Whether you've left school or you're still at school, you can appreciate the sheer fun and mayhem that chemistry can be. There's so much to it. Bunsen burners, mixing chemicals.
Very nice.
You may have been allowed to mix very small amounts of lithium with water. You may, if we're the responsible adults, have mixed H2O with sodium. And you may, under very strict scientific control, have witnessed potassium mixed with water. But the odds are, if you have, it will only ever have been on one of those rubbish science videos. There you go, my friend. These next two are the dog's nuts of the periodic table. They are, if you like, a king and queen of alkaline metals. Mix these babies with water, stand well back, and watch the mayhem. And that's just what we're going to do. Mr. Tickle, bring on the rubidium.
Here it is.
Is that it?
Well, it might not look like much, Richard, but it's a highly reactive metal. It's sealed in this glass tube under argon atmosphere conditions, just for safety.
Right, so what's going to happen when you drop that in the water?
Well, imagine, if you will, letting off a hand grenade in a bathtub.
Righto, I'm off. Have that.
Okay, good luck.
Okay, Tickle, drop the rubidium in the water.
Everybody,
2 grams of rubidium will only react when our specially designed vial dissolves in the water, which gives John a few crucial seconds to get into our safety zone.
But I believe we can go one better. There is one more alkaline metal we can really use.
Yes, Richard, cesium, the emperor of alkaline metals, particularly nasty, could go off at any time.
And that's it.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I like it already. Now, what's that going to do when it hits the water?
Imagine a depth charge in a bathtub.
Fair enough, mate. I'll leave it to it.
Good luck.
Thank you. Okay, John, go for it.
Warning, extreme danger, clear the area.
As our cesium sinks in the water, the rapid generation of hydrogen gas should produce quite an explosion. And it does.
Magnificent. And I think that concludes today's experiment. There is, I should say, one more, even more reactive metal, francium. But for some reason, they wouldn't let us have any of that. So there you go. Today's lesson, never mix alkaline metals with water.
But
here's rubidium. Rubidium in water reacts much more violent than potassium. Rubidium again. So as we go down the alkali metals, they become more and more reactive. So now, let's take a look at the next metal, cesium.
I show these two videos back to back for several reasons, but the first one is just to introduce the alkali metals. We're talking here about group 1A. Hydrogen may or may not be part of it. And at the very beginning, they showed lithium, which was kind of whatever in water. Sodium is much more exciting. Potassium is much more exciting than that. But what they tried to show there was rubidium and cesium. So notice as you go down the periodic table, the reactivity increased first of all. Now in that first Brainiac, whatever it was, video, I mean, it was like, yeah, you know, kind of like a music video kind of quality.
Yeah,
lots of explosion. Yeah, right on. But there's controversy around that because as you can see in this little video here, rubidium and cesium like may not be quite as exciting as that video laid on. So I'll leave it to you to figure out if Brainiac was just doing kind of a showman's job on us or if it was real. But what you do see, and what will be probably in your brains now forever, is that these guys do react really well with water. They're all really soft. You can cut them and stuff like that. These people didn't use as much cesium as, for example, as the other group did. I'm not quite sure, though, if you'd have that big blowout of the bathtub on the other hand. So anyway, these guys are pretty exciting. So
when magnesium metal burns, the product of the reaction has a greater mass than that of the original magnesium. John Dalton's atomic theory successfully explained this seemingly strange result.
We looked at this earlier. This is magnesium burning. It makes kind of a bright light when it burns. And the magnesium before had less mass than the magnesium compound after. And they found out that it's magnesium oxide, so the oxygen came up. It's actually historically kind of cool. Here's a picture of pure calcium. Barium gives really cool green fireworks. Strontium gives red. Most of these exist only in compounds. So like you can find magnesium oxide and magnesium carbonate, things like that, in the wild, but you don't usually find the pure metal, except for beryllium. Beryllium, you can find some. Now, group 3A, the icosagens, which I will call twisted metals for a reason we'll talk about as we go through this course, includes boron, aluminum, gallium, indium, thallium, all right? Aluminum is really important. It's a big part of the Earth's crust. Boron is cool. Sometimes you hear about the liquid spoon, all right, or the disappearing spoon. At the turn of the 20th century, chemists would do these jokes on they would come over for tea or whatever, and they'd hand their friend a spoon, and it was the spoon of gallium. And the reason why it was a joke is that even in your hand, the gallium will melt, turns into liquid. So they put their spoon in to stir the sugar in the tea or whatever, and the spoon was gone. I hope they didn't drink the gallium afterwards. Thallium is a really interesting element because it's so toxic. You'll hear a lot of cool forensic stories about people using thallium to poison other people. Now, group 4 is a mixture of carbon and silicon, which are both really important for life, of course, carbon. Silicon, really important for the earth. On the other hand, down here, tin and lead have a lot of uses that are quite different than carbon and silicon. Group 4 has the most disparity when you go down it, all right? Like the top ones are the most different from the bottom ones of all the different groups, and we'll see that. We'll talk about it.
To get to the heart of the global warming story, the very heart of it, you've got to look past lonely polar bears and past melting glaciers and past the changing climate, because behind the scary news and the very scary Hollywood movie, it turns out that the scientific explanation for global warming depends to a very large degree on one particular atom, the atom that we call
carbon.
Right. The more you know about this atom, the more you're going to know about global warming. First of all, it's everywhere. The lead, what we call lead in the pencil, it's not lead. It's
carbon.
Diamonds.
Carbon.
You.
Me.
Yeah, you. You are mostly water, but if I squeeze you like a sponge, your dry weight, what's left of you, you're about two-thirds carbon.
Great. Carbon's great, but can I have my everything else back, please?
Yes, carbon is the central element of life. So much so that everything that is alive, and I mean everything, from an amoeba to a whale, from a dandelion to a redwood tree, in fact, inside every cell, in every creature bar none, you will find
carbon.
And why?
Yeah, why?
Because as the science writer Natalie Angier says, carbon is the duct tape of life. It stitches living things together. Carbon atoms are built to attach, to ram on to other atoms. They have, as you see, four points of attachment, and they love attaching. They can form jungle gyms. This is the inside of a diamond. They form sheets. This is graphite in a pencil. They form spheres. They are very social, which is why they are so suited to living things. Living things, after all, come in all kinds of shapes, and carbon can make them fall. But it's carbon's special ability to grab on, to grasp other atoms, that is now getting us in trouble. What starts down at the atomic level can, if we're not careful, lead to big, and I mean very big, problems.
So carbon is the heart of carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases. And this is a much longer video that I just showed this part about it. But what I did want you to see was how carbon had four hands. And those four hands are something we'll talk about, especially in Chem 222. But if two of the hands grab one oxygen and two of the hands grab another oxygen, that makes CO2. And that's a very, very stable bond, hard to break. Carbon is not only good at making bonds with other atoms, it's also very fast with making bonds too. And both of those things are important for life. But when you make CO2, there's some problems. So we'll talk a lot more about this group and stuff as we go through. Nitrogen and the other pentoxygens, which is what they're called, are kind of clever too. Nitrogen is also really important for life. There's one compound with nitrogen we're going to talk about a lot, and I want you to know this name slash memorize, all right? Ammonia, if you know about it or not, is super important for so many things, all right? We'll talk about it a lot. We used ammonium hydroxide in our first lab. Ammonia itself is a gas, but when you add H2O to it, that's what makes ammonium hydroxide. So just realize ammonia is going to pop up quite a bit. Phosphorus, obviously important for a lot of things. Arsenic, another toxic thing. Bismuth has a lot of cool colors. We'll see more of these guys coming up too. But I do want to have a special shout out, if you will, to this guy. His name was Grant. And in 1669, he was thought, my urine is gold. And at the time, alchemy, which was big, they were after basically things like finding gold. They thought things were pure. And so he actually took his own urine and apparently others, trying to find gold in it. And there's no gold in our urine, man. He did find phosphorus, which is really cool. All right, and phosphorus arguably is even more important than gold, but just realize that this was a special case. Yeah.
Isn't bismuth unnaturally made, or is it unnaturally made better?
It can be unnaturally made, but most of ours is like natural and stuff like that. Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. We'll talk about that, how to make those things unnaturally in Chem 222. Group 6A is a group that's really important, and you've been using it just since we've been here in lecture, because the chalcogens include oxygen, and I'll show you the silly little video here in a second. But I do want to talk a little bit about sulfur. Sulfur is really important for lots of things. That sulfur smell. You need a little selenium in your diet every day and stuff. It's an important antioxidant. But oxygen, like I said, is kind of a cool thing.
Today, students, we're going to learn about oxygen. Element number 8,
atomic mass 16, and an ambitious young student in
element. Sorry, it's your. It's time for recess. Let's observe as oxygen tries to make friends on the playground. Here's helium, all alone on the carousel. Not having much luck, is he? Perhaps oxygen can give him a hand. See that, students? Oxygen repels helium, much like a magnet. Looks as though helium has gone off to play somewhere else. See, oxygen has made friends with iron. It's unfortunate, however, that they won't be able to play on that seesaw for long, since oxygen causes most metals to rust. I think someone should get the nurse.
This is
Oxygen has recovered quickly from his silver and can now be seen playing with barium. But they should be careful playing in that rocket, since oxygen is often used as ignition in engines. Curiously enough, barium is also used in fireworks, which produce a brilliant green hue. Sad oxygen. Maybe hydrogen can be your friend. See, nothing bad will happen. That is, unless a second one jumps in.
H2O.
That's it for oxygen. Be sure to watch our next lesson, where we investigate the effects of helium in the upper atmosphere.
So there's actually a lot of little interesting pieces of this video. It was some art house project that someone sent me for, and it's kind of clever. But I like the idea that, helium and oxygen don't combine. Oxygen combines with a lot of things, but not helium. You can also, of course, when water forms, you no longer have the pure oxygen. It's in a different phase. We'll talk about it. Oxygen and carbon are, I would argue, the most social elements on the periodic table. And what I mean by that is they don't have cool social media following. It means that they react with so many other elements, all right? And that's what gets them into trouble. And that's also why when you have carbon dioxide, there's a huge effect on our environment and stuff like that.
The reaction of sodium and chlorine is a vigorous one. We use sand to protect the flask from excessive heat. Then, we fill the flask with chlorine gas. Next, we add sodium. And then a few drops of water to activate the reaction. The reaction produces sodium chloride.
Chlorine is a gas at room temperature, and if you were to breathe chlorine in, it would kill you. It's really powerful stuff. On the other hand, we saw earlier how sodium, one of the alkali metals, you place it in water, explosions, so you take a piece of sodium metal and you swallow it. Also bad news for your body. On the other hand, sodium chloride, the product of chlorine and sodium coming together, is very safe. I mean, you can have too much sodium chloride and stuff like that, but more or less safe. And I bring this out because the properties of things you make are often quite different than the properties of the things you start with. And this is a real common occurrence in chemistry. You can also see that a lot of energy is released. We're going to talk later about how to analyze the amount of energy. Stuff like that. The halogens provides a great way to talk about the phases of matter. And in this classroom, as well as 2501 and 2507, there's a subtle color scheme that you may or may not have been hip to. The red elements are gases at room temperature and room pressure. So you can see that in group 7 on the far right, fluorine and chlorine are both red. Those are both gases at room temperature. Bromine and mercury are two liquids, the only two liquids at room temperature and pressure. So if you see something blue, that means it's a liquid. And then the black things are solids. So iodine and acetone are solids. So the colors themselves will sometimes give you a hint as to what's going on. Very important things, yeah.
So we were talking in my geography class about how chlorine is causing some serious problems with the ozone layer.
Mm-hmm.
And we were curious if maybe chlorine, like chlorine bleach, using bleach, does that have the same reaction, like the, I don't know, the vapors that come off of it,
I guess? Totally. So you're right, chlorine, when it gets in the stratosphere or wherever the oxygen is, it's a catalyst. And so what it means is it takes the ozone, and it transforms it into regular oxygen, so there's no more things. But every chlorine can make like 100,000 of these kind of things go through. If the chlorine gets in there, then it's a problem. Now, I would argue that bleach, all right, is a special form of chlorine, and we'll see more about this later. I think it would be difficult anyway to get the chlorine in bleach as a liquid, as a different state of chlorine, into the atmosphere. I'm more worried about the chlorine leaks and the CFCs, the things that are natural gases going up. So I'm not going to say it's impossible, but I would say it's very difficult to get that.
Okay, interesting. Thank you.
That's my perspective. The last section is kind of cool. They're now called the noble gases in group 8A. And you can see that all of that column on the periodic table in this room, all of those elements are red. They used to be called inert gases, but people in the 50s and 60s started to make compounds with them. Later on, we'll talk more about this one, XeOF4. The middle atom is a xenon atom. This is an oxygen, and these green ones are fluorines. Helium has been used, of course, for ballooning for a long time, as well as hydrogen. The United States and North America has a lot of helium. Europe had more hydrogen. So in the 30s, when the Zeppelin came over, they were using a hydrogen-based balloon system, which is very flammable. The good thing about being in our part of the neck is that helium is not flammable. It's very, very stable.
There's a finite amount of helium on Earth, right?
Yeah, and it's slowly going down. They use it from gas deposits. They
right. There's caves underneath Texas where they store it in the U.S. out there.
I don't know about that. Now, one of my favorite groups on the periodic table is something we haven't talked about yet. The A groups on the far left and the A groups on the far right, those are called the main group elements, all right? And so the 1A and 2A, as well as the 3A, which starts right there over to 8A, I would call those the main group elements. But there's another set of elements in the middle. They have B designations on our periodic table that we're using here. And those are called transition metals. And the transition metals are really cool. They're a lot different than the other metals we're going to see. Down here is another set of metals with two like long strips. The first row along there, these are called lanthanides. And the second group on the bottom, those are called actinides. Sometimes lanthanides and actinides are placed in the same group as transition metals because they do have some similar characteristics, but actually I feel they're quite different. But again, metal is my thing. Rust is something that we've all probably had to deal with at one point or another. Rust is an iron 3 oxide, and in the next section we'll talk about what this little Roman numeral here means. But one thing I do want to introduce is that most of these metals, most of the transition metals, we'll need to have some kind of a Roman numeral there, and that'll be the focus of our next section, like what's going on. The reason, though, why I really like metals more than the other main group metals or the non-metals is because of their color. And that sounds kind of silly, and I apologize, but colors to me always seem really neat. Organic chemistry, which is a huge part of chemistry, if you're lucky, it's white, sometimes black, and if you're unlucky, it's a brown compound. But that's basically it. It's white, black, and sometimes, if you're unlucky, brown. But my metals, oh man, they have a lot of really cool colors to them. And for me, aesthetically, that was important. We'll talk a little bit in Chem 223 about why they have different colors like that, but you don't usually see these kind of colors with the main group metals and non-metals. You only see them with these guys. So anyway, that's kind of the end of this section. And again, this section is mostly on figuring out how the atoms and the elements work and how to figure out like protons, electrons, and stuff like that. But we haven't really delved very deeply into what makes a compound. And that's going to be the focus now of this next section. So instead of having just aluminum, or instead of having just oxygen, we're going to see what happens when the two of them come together. And you can see here an early description of how they were making the dirt molecule, and I love this. You can see there's like a bunch of DEs in a circle. Anyway, obviously I have a strong sense of humor. This is, again, a mixture of mostly chapter 2, but a little bit of chapter 3 as well. We're going to be focusing more on how to figure out what a molecule and a compound is, and to do that, we're going to have to talk about something called an ion. So this will be the next section stuff in this particular area. But first, a little poetry. Auntie Jane fed to baby Nell what she thought was calomel. What the baby really ate was corrosive sublimate. Not much difference, even I must confess. Just one chlorine more and one baby less. Corrosive sublimate and calomel are both mercury-containing compounds. And if there's one chlorine or two chlorines, it makes a huge difference. Calomel, HGCl, apparently is something they will give sometimes to newborns. It's a thing that helps prevent bacteria buildup or whatever. On the other hand, this corrosive sublimate, HGCl2. Now, why I bring out this gross thing is not to talk about babies dying, that's for sure. But notice these formulas, all right? This has one mercury, Hg, and one chlorine. This one has, of course, one Hg and two chlorines. So one chlorine more makes a huge difference in the reactivity, all right? What is relatively safe, calomel, becomes incredibly unsafe with just one more chlorine. And of course, let's have another joke, why not?
I'm a chemist, so I will just have some H2O. Can I take your drink order? I'll have H2O. LOL. I will have some H2O too. And the bartender brings them both, like a glass of what looks like water. Thanks. Glug, 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 glug. All right, and then the dude goes, idiot. Now, why this person is kind of idiotic is because H2O is the ingredient of everything we drink, right? And we need water all the time.
But this person said H2O2. So the bartender, who knew enough about formulas then, knew that it was not H2O, it was H2O2, two oxygens. Does anybody know the common name of H2O2? Hydrogen peroxide, well done. Hydrogen peroxide looks just like water. You can buy it at Bi-Mart and stuff like that. It looks like water, but don't you dare drink it, man. It'll have to fuck this person. So make sure you say H2O or just call it by water. All right, so punchline here, one extra atom, huge differences in reactivity, and you must know what you have. You should also not drink anything in lab, but I don't need to go there. Okay, so what we're going to do in this section is we're going to look now at more of the molecules that form, all right? We're going to see the different combinations. This is an example of a combination of carbon and hydrogen. This is a sodium and a chlorine. The red ones, I believe, are the sodiums, and the green ones are chlorines. We're also going to talk a little bit more, though, about the elements, too, all right? For example, carbon exists in multiple stages. This is one thing called buckyball. And on the other hand, just like you wouldn't want to drink H2O2, but you can drink H2O, you wouldn't want to breathe O3 ozone, all right? O3 ozone is quite a bit different on our bodies than just O2 oxygen, the oxygen we breathe. So we'll also talk about some of these elemental forms and what they're up to. A compound is a mixture of two or more elements, and the compound will always have the same ratio. And so H2O water is always two hydrogens and one oxygen. It's never one hydrogen and one oxygen or something like that. If you break the compound down to the smallest piece, you end up with a molecule. So like we did earlier with Democritus and gold, if I have a sample of water, you can cut it in half and have a smaller sample. Cut that, have a smaller sample. Down, 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 down. Finally, you have a molecule of water. And if you break that molecule, it won't be water anymore. It might be hydrogen and oxygen or something, but it won't be the same as what you've done. So the smallest piece of an element is an atom. The smallest piece of a compound is a molecule. And you can turn, arguably, molecules into atoms if you need to. Having a way to represent the number of atoms in a molecule is critical. And so I want to introduce here what's going on. We talked last week about how an atom can have an upper left-hand number and a lower left-hand number. And the lower left-hand number was called the atomic number. That's the blue number on the periodic table. So like carbon, we know, would always have a 6 down in the lower left-hand number because it has 6 protons. The upper left number is what they call the mass number, and that's equal to protons plus neutrons. So unless you know what kind of isotope it is, you usually don't have that upper left number. But we're going to talk now about what goes in the lower right, and then in a while we'll talk about what goes in the upper right. And the lower right is equal to the number of atoms in a formula. So this is an example of a picture of what's called glycine molecule. The black atoms are carbon, the reds are oxygens, This is nitrogen, and the whites are hydrogen. Instead of drawing this out like a cool picture like this person did, we can represent it as a formula, C2H5NO2. Notice that the N does not have a 1 there, all right? If there's only one atom, you just leave it by itself. If it was 0, you wouldn't put the atom in. So C2H5NO2 means you've got 2 carbons, 5 hydrogens, 1 nitrogen, and 2 oxygens. So H2O is like this kind of a formula, all right? It says 2 hydrogens and 1 oxygen in the molecule.
Yeah.
Is there an importance of the order?
There's different ways to do the formula, absolutely. So instead of writing it C2H5NO2, you will sometimes see glycine listed like this, which has more information on the way that the atoms are put together. Now notice that if you're the lazy chemist slash me, this takes a little bit more effort to write than it does this kind right here. But the advantage of this is you can see how there's like an NH2 followed by a CH2, and then COOH is something we'll see a lot of. So if you write it like this, it does sometimes show more about like how the atoms are put together. It's not as common as this kind of formula, but it is an alternative you'll see sometimes.
Well, like, could you do
NO2 to see if it's carbon? Right on. In these formulas, usually carbon is first, hydrogen is second, nitrogen, oxygen, and then anything else is beyond. Good. That's a good question, too. I didn't see your question, man, so sorry about that. Yeah. This thing here is called it's more like an ordering of the atoms. You can also draw things that look like this. This is more like a Lewis structure. We'll talk about Lewis structures in Chem 222. All of these are different ways to write these, okay, and they all have advantages. In Chem 222, we'll talk more about these kind of structures right here. If you see this right here, though, sometimes you have to interpret that this and this are the same. When they're expanded out, it does help the chemist to see what the formula is and what particular molecule it is, but it can be a little deceiving at first. All right, here's glycine in other ways that you can draw it. Now remember, glycine is still C2H5NO2 or whatever. This is the way that shows more information on the geometry. And again, if you've seen a Lewis structure, that's kind of what that is right there. In terms of some of the reactivity, though, what's called a ball and stick representation can be really helpful. You can see how there's like weird bond angles associated that you don't see right here. And so sometimes these kind will be helpful. But really, how atoms work is the atoms kind of smash together really close to each other. And each atom is kind of like a sphere. So you can see like this sphere of oxygen and this sphere of carbon are kind of like squished together. They call these molecules space-filling molecules. I find them the least helpful at this level, but sometimes in high-level calculations, it's nice to know like how close this oxygen is to this carbon. So if you see this, this is just an alternate way to represent this molecule.
So in the ball and stick form, I'm noticing that there's 2 bars connecting the carbon to the oxygen.
Yeah.
What does that mean necessarily?
Cool. Most bonds, can I use your hands, man? Most bonds are like this. Hey, what's going on? I haven't seen you since Friday. However, once in a while, double bond. Haven't seen you for a long time. So good to see you, man. This is called a double bond, and it does happen. And sometimes you can even have a triple bond and stuff as well.
Okay.
We'll talk about those in 2022. Thank you for being my model. Excellent question. Other question? Yes.
Yes.
So we're going to talk about such glue that holds things together, but yeah, it's about how the electrons are interacting with each other. That's right. Here's ethanol. Ethanol is drinking alcohol. Just say no, kids. But anyway, ethanol's formula, one way to represent it, is a CH3CH2OH. and the reason this is kind of cool is it shows that there's a CH3 on the end, CH2, and then an OH. This kind of drawing is called a perspective drawing, and you can see how there's a CH3, CH2 in the middle, and the OH. Now notice these dark kind of wedge lines and these kind of dashed lines. This is a way that scientists try and represent three dimensions on a two-dimensional space. It's trying to show that this carbon is coming out of the board at us. And the little dashed lines are going back into the board. This is obviously inferior to something like this, which shows the molecules a little bit better. But sometimes you have to have like a more powerful program to represent those kind of representations. Now, here's kind of an overview of some formula representations that we're going to use. And I want to talk about the one which is hopefully pretty familiar, which is water. Now, water has a formula, a molecular formula of H2O. And that means that in water, you're going to have two hydrogens and one oxygen all the time, okay? An empirical formula is the smallest whole number ratio of atoms. So I have two hydrogens and one oxygen. In an empirical formula, you always want to use whole numbers. So yes, H1O½ would work, but in an empirical formula in this class, use whole numbers. So in this case, the empirical and the molecular are the same. I'll show you an example here in a little bit of when they aren't the same. But in reality, water isn't two hydrogens together and an oxygen on the end. What it really is there's an oxygen in the middle of the hydrogens. So oxygen has like two hands to grasp on. One hand on the left, if you will, grabs one hydrogen, and one on the right grabs the other. So sometimes we'll talk about a structural form of water showing what the atoms look like. Now, the H2O2 that the poor chemist ordered in the bar is, as we talked about, hydrogen peroxide. It's two hydrogens to every two oxygens. So notice here, this is where the empirical formula is pretty obvious. You can divide both of those twos by two, of course, and find that the smallest whole number ratio is HO. There's a reason why we're talking about empirical formulas, and we'll talk about those at the end of this chapter. But for right now, just realize, if you can make the molecular version, you can divide those by a number and get whole numbers in a smaller version. That's what the empirical formula is. H2O2 has an oxygen-oxygen bond, all right? And on the end of each of the oxygens is one hydrogen. So HOOH is the way to represent it when it comes to structure. Ethylene, ethane, ethanol, and dimethyl ether are all very similar. And I think it's helpful to look at how these things play out. So ethylene, C2H4, the empirical formula, if you divide the 2 and the 4 by 2, you get CH2. And this is what the molecule looks like. It's H2C and the CH2 on the other side. Ethane is similar to ethylene, but you can see it has two more hydrogens. So if you divide both of these numbers by 2, you get CH3. And again, there's a carbon-carbon link inside there. Now, why I show these last two is notice how both of these, ethanol, which is drinking alcohol, and another compound called dimethyl ether, they both are C2H6O, all right? They both have the same formula. Notice that you can't divide these numbers by any number and get whole numbers over here. All right, you get fractions if you divided them all by two, but we don't want to keep them in fractions. So the empirical and the molecular formulas are the same. But the way that they're oriented in space is actually quite different. If you notice here on ethanol, there's a CH3, a CH2, and then an OH like on the end, if you will. And this is the one that's the main ingredient of drinking alcohol. This one, on the other hand, has a CH3, an oxygen in the middle, and a CH3 on the end. Dimethyl ether is actually a gas at room temperature, and you don't want to be playing with this stuff too much. It's flammable, does lots of kind of crazy things. So we'll talk about Molecular formulas, that's going to be the naming part of this next section. And later on, we'll come back to this molecular empirical formula kind of thing. And then finally, as we go through this course, we'll start looking more and more at what a structural formula is. And you can hopefully see like why all of these things are really important. All right, several of you had your hands up and stuff, so yeah.
Isn't OH kind of basic?
OH with a metal is the active part of a base, absolutely. OH with a non-metal, though, like carbon, is quite different. It's more neutral. So you can drink, like, drinking alcohol, but you wouldn't want to drink sodium hydroxide, man. That would be, like, really bad on your throat. Yeah, trips to the hospital. Did you have a question?
It got answered.
Okay, thank cool. You. That's legit, yeah. Any other questions? P4O10 is the active ingredient, supposedly in phosphorus shells in the military. And again, I don't know very much about that. But anyway, let's say that I asked you to find the empirical formula. So remembering that you want to take the molecular formula, which is what P4O10 is, and you want to find the smallest whole number ratio of atoms, all right? So for example, if you divide both 4 and 10 by 4, you get P1O2.5. But is that legit by these kind of rules? No, right on. No fractions, all right? No fractions of these kind of things. So instead of dividing by 4, what can we divide this by to get whole numbers?
2.
Well done. If you divide 4 by 2, it gets 2. If you divide 10 by 2, you get 5. P2O5 would be the empirical formula of this molecule. Any questions? An allotrope is a name given to an element that exists in more than one form, all right? We've already talked here a little bit about oxygen, which you can breathe, and ozone, which you wouldn't want to breathe. That would be bad news, man. It's good in the atmosphere, but not good down here next to you. Carbon is the king of allotropes. It has so many, and some of these names you probably have heard of before. Graphite is carbon, but it's carbon in little tiny sheets. And your pencils, when you write with a pencil, like part of the sheet like hangs out on the pencil afterwards. It's really cool. Diamond is also carbon, all right? And diamond, of course, is quite different than graphite. First of all, diamond is rough. It would rip your paper right through. It's really expensive. They're rare and stuff like that. But again, remember, both of these are carbon. It's just how they're arranged in space that you're seeing the differences. Now, this is a newer player on the block. It's called a buckyball. It has 60 carbon atoms, literally in the arrangement of like a soccer ball. So sometimes buckyballs, soccer balls, etc. It was named after a guy named Buckminster Fullerene, who was really, really cool, and he's an interesting person to look up. So again, this is also carbon, but it's a lot different than the other ones. Buckyball was found in dust. People were like, I wonder what this dust is, you know, when they looked at their instrument. Well, long story short, Nobel Prizes later, woohoo, Buckminster Fullerene. There's also graphene and a whole bunch of different ones and stuff, so just be aware that all of these are allotropes, the same element, but different forms. But the one thing that you just gotta know in this class, I don't care so much about the diamond graphite thing, but you have to know these 7 diatomics. Now, have no fear of ice clear brew. It is not my call of arms to make you all start drinking alcohol. And by the way, it could be Ruger, let's be honest. However, have no fear of ice clear brew is a way to designate what's called the 7 diatomics. Now, most elements on the periodic table exist as monatomics, individual atoms. But these crazy 7 right here, have no fear of ice clear brew, refer to the 7 diatomics. They're all nonmetals, they're really common, and they're going to be super important when we start doing manipulations of atoms into molecules and compounds. Now, I have always liked the have no fear of ice clear brew because it shows, but there's also like Hankel Brif. That's another way that sometimes people know. There's also, oh shoot, I didn't do it. There's another one, shoot, I can't remember. Well, anyway, there's many different versions and different ways to do these seven diatomics, but please know these seven diatomics are going to be really important and they're going to pop up. This slide, which I skipped you on accidentally, shows also phosphorus, sulfur, talks about oxygen. So it's not just the seven diatomics, but it's pretty important. All right, this is a great place to stop. Have a wonderful day. I will see you all soon.